Well, fascinating discussion tonight. We're going to take your phone calls with Joel when we come right back now on Coast to Coast AM. Joel, why does this seem to be going so quickly these days, this enhancement, everything?
Well, because we're seeing a curve of change that unlike anything we've had in human history. There's something that you probably heard of, I'm not sure about all of your listeners, called Moore's Law.
Yes.
Back in, you know, in 1959, we built the first commercial computer chip. 6 years later, in 1965, there was a guy named Gordon E. Moore, who was a physical chemist in the Silicon Valley. And he noticed that the number of transistors that you could get onto a computer chip for a dollar had been regularly doubling. And he boldly predicted that that was going to continue for another 10 years. Well, little did he know. Gordon E. Moore ended up becoming one of the three founders of Intel, Intel Inside, the computer chip guys. And he's now a bazillionaire a million times over.
Of course.
But he's probably going to be most remembered in history for what is now known as Moore's Law, which is because that's now the core faith of the entire global information technology.
And it's accurate, I think.
That's right. That's right. And the way it's now stated is that the amount of computer firepower that you can get for a buck will double every 18 months or as far as the eye can see. Well, we've now had 32 doublings since 1959. That's an increase of over 1 billion times in the lifetime of most of the people who are listening to this. We've never seen anything like that before in human history. The closest thing that I can think of that's anywhere remotely close was that back in the 1800s, the number of railroad miles doubled 14 and a half times in the United States between 1840 and 1910, and that changed everything. It changed cities, it changed corporations, it changed jobs, it changed farming, it changed families, everything. And that was only 14 and a half doublings until finally, you know, but the thing is that railroads are made out of physical stuff. You need, you know, coal and iron and land and all that. There's only so much of that on any planet. So that had to level off. Information technology, by contrast, the only limits that I can see are human ingenuity, the marketplace, and the laws of quantum mechanics, of physics. And as a practical matter, I don't see any limits to any of those. So the only limit that I can see is culture and values, our ability to control our own inventions by making decisions, which is at the heart of the prevail scenario that I talked about that I'm working at Arizona State. Now, the thing is that all of these other technologies that are kicking in, and the GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, nanotechnology, they are made possible by these information technology. Take genetics, for example. Back in 1985, when people first started talking about sequencing the human genome, people said, oh, that's impossible. And if we could make it work, it's going to take, you know, decades and it's going to cost the Earth. Well, it all happened 15 years later and a tiny fraction of the price. And the reason is that the computers that you use to sequence the genome just dropped in price to nothing. I mean, you know, who hasn't had the experience of looking at some whiz-bang computer as a Christmas present for $2,000,
yeah,
and the next Christmas it costs $1,300.
Same with a high definition television.
Same thing, exactly. You know, that $2,000 computer, the same amount of firepower 10 years later, according to Moore's Law, would be available for $31.25, and you'd get it for free with a subscription to Newsweek. You know, I mean, probably a lot of people carrying in their pockets thumb drives. You know, those little things, those little computer memory things.
Sure.
I got one in my pocket. I haven't paid for one of those in my life. I just get them as like party favors, you know. I just got one for free. It had 16 gigabytes in it. That's more than the biggest Cray supercomputer in the 70s. You know, and that's what's advancing this. Nanotechnology is the same way. Nanotechnology, we're talking about fundamentally controlling matter and energy. Think about that. Fundamentally controlling matter and energy, and the machines that allow that to occur are all information technology. And the same, this goes back to, you know, to human health and to conquering aging. One of the things that I'm really interested in is whether whether hospitals are going to go the same way as newspapers, whether hospitals are going to be increasingly obsolete in the next 15 years. One of the things that you're seeing is the rise of labs on a chip. Basically, there's one of them here at Arizona State. It's about the size of a bread box. And what happens is that you spit into it and in the morning, every morning, and it sends the information about your metabolism from analyzing your spit up to the computer cloud. Think of it as like Google Medicine.
Yeah.
And what it does is it compares your metabolism this morning to your metabolism previous mornings and to everybody else's metabolism. And this allows you to determine days, weeks, months, years in advance whether something is going wrong with your metabolism.
And fix it right away.
Well, what if that becomes widespread, and there's no particular reason to think that it won't, then you know what you're talking about is ending the disease model of dealing with health. Right now, we wait for symptoms to occur, and we intervene heroically at the last minute when you got symptoms. Well, of course it costs the earth if you wait that long.
I want one of these things.
Right. I mean, it's not right now.
And they'll be portable too, won't they?
Well, that's right. And right now, this thing costs $1 zillion. It's a lab model, but because the arithmetic of Moore's law means that in 15 years you're going to have 10 doublings of these things, or it's going to come down in price by half, 10 times. What that means practically is that anything that costs any information product that costs $1 million today and is in a hospital will be available to you in 15 years for $1,000, and it'll be on your kitchen counter. It also means that anything that's available today as an information product that costs $1,000 will be available to you as for $1, and it'll be pocket lint. You know, how many people have ID cards that they're issued by their employer to get them into the building? You have to swipe the card to unlock the door.
Most of us, yeah.
Most of us, right? It's okay. You know, well, those smart cards, embedded in those smart cards is a computer that's equivalent to a 365 Pentium. Remember those?
Yeah.
Those were hot dog computers back in the day. They're now in
now
that
it's a card.
They're now in the card for less than $5. When you're finished with it, you throw it away.
Let's take some calls, Joel. Amazing. John in Buffalo, New York. Welcome to Coast. You're up with us. Hey, John.
Hi, George. Hi, doctor. How are you both?
Not a doctor, I don't think. Are you?
No, I'm a professor.
Well, you sound smart.
Oh, yes, he does. There's no doubt about that.
Okay. I have two comments, but I do have to, that final comment you just made, I got to say that means less jobs when everything can be done on the head of a pin. But that's my comment that I didn't even plan on saying. So let me go back and my original
comment. Would you like me to respond to that, or would you?
Go ahead, respond, then we'll get the other question.
Oh, okay, respond, please. Thank you.
You know, people have been predicting that that new technologies was going to destroy their jobs for a long time, and it's true, too. I mean, there was these guys back in the early industrial age that were known as the Luddites, who would break machines because they thought that, factories would be weaving cloth for much cheaper and much faster than they could on a loom at home, and it would be the end of their lifestyles. Well, that's true. It is the end of their lifestyles, but the history of this is that as fast as you creatively destroy old jobs, you also invent new ones. I mean, most of the kids that I know today, and I've told my daughters that the job that they're going, their first real job probably hasn't been invented yet. I mean, think of things like how many people have now got jobs as webmasters? Who the hell knew what a webmaster was 10 years ago?
Yes, that's true. By the way, I've got the best.
There you go.
Good old Lex.
Yeah.
There he is. Okay, what's your next question, John?
Well, you spoke of the previous hour of the heaven scenario, the hell scenario, and something in between.
Right.
When it comes to anything that has the possibility of making money or a government using it for a power tool, they will do it. They will buy it. They will put a patent on it, and they will use it for nothing but their needs, personal needs. And I'd love to be proven wrong, but God bless my instincts. I have yet to be proven wrong on most anything. And I know that the hospitals do make, or science does make progresses, but boy, those progresses are real slow. But these things that help us destroy the world, they come real fast. So, I'm very very skeptical. I mean, I hope for the heaven, and I got the hell. It's probably going to happen. And that's a very skeptical way of looking at the world. But, hey, I'm 43 years old, and I've seen nothing but sadness.
Is it going to happen, Joel, the hell part?
I don't make predictions. I do scenarios. And the I don't know which of these scenarios is going to come true.
What's your gut tell you?
But the thing about the hell scenario is that it's the easiest one to imagine. Anybody can imagine how a complex system is going to fall apart. It's child's play. But yet, when you look at how big corporations have gone down the tubes lately, I'm always struck that the way they usually go down the tubes is not because they didn't anticipate disaster, but because of failures of optimism. So, for example, IBM, back in the early 80s, when they first introduced the IBM PC, I've got a chart on my desk that gives their predictions of how many PCs they were going to sell in the first 10 years. They were off by almost exactly a factor of 100. And that has consequences. If somebody had just said, well, suppose we're going to sell five times as many as we predict, then all sorts of things would have been different. You wouldn't have given the job of creating the operating system to this punk kid, Bill Gates, and Microsoft wouldn't exist today. Same thing for AT&T. Back in the 80s, they decided there was no future to cell phones, even though they'd invented it in Bell Labs. But these things at the time were the size.
How could they miss that?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
The thing at the time...
If you watched Dick Tracy, you knew that it was going to be big,
I know. But you see this list again and again where the big failure is the failure to think big and to think imaginatively and to think optimistically. The hell scenario is the easiest thing. In fact, people have been predicting doom and gloom and the end of society now, for millennia. And especially in the 20th century, we had a really bad 20th century, I guess, because everybody always sees the dark side at the same time that objectively you look at us and the problem isn't starvation, it's obesity. I mean, that we're the best fed, civilization on earth. You start looking objectively at our statistics and you start saying, well, why are we so worried? Why are we so pessimistic? And the answer is, I guess, that it's just so easy to imagine how this all could collapse. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen.
Good point. Next up, let's go to San Diego, west of the Rockies. Hey, Jason, go ahead. Jason?
Oh, yeah, we're here.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just calling. You had said to call in on basically people that have saved in their 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yes, tell me, do you?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I was, I guess my comment is, there's things that happen in your life that you don't foresee. In my case, basically, I worked all the way through college, started, but got a career with basically one of the biggest bigs in the world, HSBC. But basically, I had a career with them 6-7 years, and I saved. I had 401k, all that, everything. I got to a point where I thought I could go on my own. I was basically, working for them, but had a great savings and a huge 401k. You know what? I can do this on my own. I worked for them in the mortgage industry.
And how old are you now, Jason?
I'm 32 right now.
32. So you say, but what about others your age at that time? Did they save?
Yeah, we're all saving, all doing the same thing. But the thing, my point is that things happen in your life that you don't foresee. And if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't be able to support myself now. In the past 3 years, I've lost my best friend and my brother within the same year, both committed suicide.
Oh,
now my mom is terminal stage 4 cancer. So these three things, I mentally basically shut down after my best friend, then to lose your brother at the same time. And we were all best friends, we were all there together. But, life, you don't foresee those things, even though you might feel them coming or something like that. You just, I don't know. Sometimes you feel things that you know that are going to happen, but.
But you were smart enough to do this. And you know, Joel, I guess he and his group of friends saved, but I still don't think a lot of people in their 20s save, unless they get married or something.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you're right. The one thing I can say for this generation is that that's different from previous generations. I don't think a single one of them thinks that they're going to be doing the same thing at the age of 60 that they were doing at the age of 25. I think that they, you know, they're just reflexively increasingly self-reliant because they know they can't trust, you know, any of these big organizations to exist for their entire lifetime. The Generation X has got the highest ratio of business creation for themselves of any generation in American history. They're working for themselves. They're creating their own industries, their own jobs. There are more people today with their own companies than in the United States than have a union card. So, I mean, that tells you something about self-reliance, and it tells you something about how, you know, the attitudes are changing about how you get into the future and how you face the kind of uncertainties that the caller was referring to.
But you have to be prepared for the uncertainties.
I think that that's, don't you think that that's, that people are getting clued into that?
Yeah, it's part of life.
I mean, I think
these unexpected tragedies that will hit all of us in one way or another. Look, I had a friend of mine visited me in St. Louis for Thanksgiving. He and his wife came up. He trips. Joel, he's paralyzed.
Yes.
He's paralyzed now.
Yes.
And I, you know, I'm not going to get into his finances, but I'll just say this. He wasn't prepared.
How old was he?
62.
See, I think it's a generational difference. At least I hope so.
Well, he should have been prepared at that age.
Well, that's true, but I mean, but you know, but he thought probably that somebody else was going to take care of him.
Yeah. So, you know, I admire the fact that Jason was able to take care of himself in spite of the problems that he faced in his life. But, you know, we're human beings. We're going to have these ups and downs, and there's no way around it, is there?
I mean, if anything, you know, we're looking at accelerating change, and uncertainty is growing. And this is, you know, the heart of the prevail scenario is, suppose we start coming up collectively with responses, you know, to an awful lot of these challenges. I mean, if I thought that something, all of these challenges were going to be met in some fashion by some wise man in Washington, you know, it would be a lot easier to be sanguine about. But I just don't think that's going to happen. And I think a lot of this is beyond the imagination of any one individual. And what I'm interested in is how we are increasingly seeing human beings collectively responding to these new challenges in novel ways. That's at the heart of the prevail strategy. One of the things, I mean, I'm starting something called the Prevail Project at Arizona State University, mm-hmm. where we're, you know, trying to figure out how can we accelerate this response on the collectively on the parts of humans to dealing with these challenges. And some of the things that we're looking, some of the things I don't know the answer to that question yet, but I'm working on it. But some of the things we're looking at, I'm talking to professors of the Middle Ages to say, you know, how did things change when we started with the printing press? How did our thinking change? You know, all of a sudden we had, you know, brand new ways of storing and collecting and sharing information. How did that accelerate the ability to muddle through? How did that accelerate the ability to create the Renaissance, to create the Enlightenment? That's the kind of question that I'm trying to raise.
Joel, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, one of Osama bin Laden's sons and one of his wives wrote a book with Gene Sassen. And Gene will be our special guest next hour on Coast to Coast AM. It's an incredible story. And we'll be back with final phone calls with Joel Garrow in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast and back to the phones we go. New York City, Logan on the wild card line. Thanks for holding, Logan.
No problem. Hey, George, first time caller, long time listener.
Great. Good to have you with us.
I have a question for Joel, and then I have a real quick question for you, George.
Sure.
What do you think will happen first? Do you think that nanotechnology or genetic engineering would be the first to come into play once we start using different kinds of technology to, you know, stop the aging process, I guess?
Genetics will be first, hands down. Nanotechnology is the least mature of the GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotechnology. It's still in the very rudimentary phase. I mean, there are very few products commercial. What that means is that you can say just about anything you want about nanotechnology, both either good or bad, and it might be true because nobody knows because it barely exists. But genetics is way down the line. In fact, what we're doing now is working on the really important stuff, which is working on how to manipulate proteins. Proteins are the parts of that actually do the business of the cells. And, you know, when you're down to that level, you're really talking about controlling life. In fact, one of my colleagues at Arizona State University is working on creatures that eat carbon dioxide and poop gasoline. And,
that's,
you know,
crazy.
Yeah, that's, you know, so that's well along.
That's cool to know. I'm 20, so, you know, I figure I might see some of this stuff.
Oh, yeah, you will.
Maybe so. Go ahead with your other question, Morgan.
Have you ever watched the show V, George, on ABC?
Yes, just once. I haven't had time to see all of them.
Hey, do you remember the kid who rode the motorcycle?
No.
Tyler Evans.
Is that you?
I'm the kid on that show. I just thought I'd tell you.
For really? Good for
you. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I've been listening to you since I was 16, and I moved to Chicago to start learning how to act. And
good for you.
My dad and I always listen to you, and you know, when we call each other, we always talk about Coast to Coast. So
now I gotta go. Now I gotta go look at your work.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Logan.
Take it easy.
All right. Small world, isn't it?
Yep.
Next up, we go to Harrisburg, Virginia. Marty on the wild card line. Hi, Marty.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I just like to agree with the fact that how some of the old religious doctrine has really caused a stumbling block in, you know, the progression of all of us as a society. And at the same time, that the religious folks maybe need to open their minds more, and we need to see the scientific people maybe guard their minds a little bit more so we can have a happy medium.
I don't know if we'll ever have that happy medium, Joel.
Well, back at the beginning of the 20th century, it was thought that, you know, that as education progressed and so forth, that religion would disappear and that scientific rationalism would take over. Well, that obviously hasn't happened. In fact, brain scientists who are, you know, looking into the more they understand about the brain, the more they think that that humans seem to be hardwired to have some sort of faith in something. We're pattern-seeking, storytelling animals. We cannot stand the idea of meaninglessness. I mean, you look up at the night sky, and rather than think that that's a random distribution of stars, what do humans do? We come up with these stories about constellations. These most elaborate stories about princes and kings and lions and bears and so forth, because we just can't stand a lack of pattern. So I understand that, and I understand the impulse, to have religious faith, especially as change is accelerating. As change accelerates, you know, naturally you look for something solid to hang on to. And so, so if somebody comes along and says, I have the answer, well, of course he's going to get adherence, especially as change accelerates. I can live with that. That's not my problem. My problem is that, you know, as change accelerates in the case of climate and so forth, the thing is that we're going to have to be adaptive and we're going to have to be resilient. And the question is, you know, how can you move forward and deal with these new realities as they come by, you know, at the same time that you keep, you know, that you accept your religious faith. It can be done. You know, you are seeing evangelical Christians who are increasingly embracing environmental causes as part of creation, of their belief in creation and in controlling creation. But it makes me nervous because religion has a bad habit of not moving fast.
So true. And here he is, by the way, Logan Huffman, playing Tyler Evans in V. He's been in all four episodes so far. It's pretty good.
Cool.
Pretty good. He's got a good little career going. Good for you, Logan. Let's go to Jeff in Birmingham, Alabama, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
And I have just a word about haptics. You were saying something a moment ago about how the thumb drive has more memory than the Cray computers back in the 1970s. But, you know, that to me is what a computer is supposed to look like. To me, computers should be these large devices that have guys in white coats.
Univacs.
Like a kitchen appliance,
yeah.
You know. I mean, so could we see a resurgence or come back with the old knobs and switches and dials? I'd like to see more of that, because imagine if you were to go back to the industrial approach through nanomechanics, the old mechanical fire control computers you used to see on ships, make a MEMS version of that, perhaps a nanowire-based rote memory like they would use on Apollo. What worries or something like a barometer clock, something that's not chip-based necessarily. Because I wonder if by trying to replace some of the older technologies, we might be blinding ourselves. So to me, nanotechnology is something that should always be added to your arsenal of technology, and not something that replaces some of the older ways we do business.
Well, I don't think that'll ever happen. Do you, Joel? I don't think we'll go back to tubes and knobs and things like
no,
that.
No, I mean, well, we're not. I can't imagine the scenario in which we return to, you know, from the chip to tubes. But the idea of the feel of a device, that I certainly can imagine us, you know, so that, you know, the feel of a knob in your hands, the feel of a doorknob, you know, I think that, I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in is that the more this technology accelerates, the more I see us heading back to pre-industrial age situations. I'm really struck by the fact that it seems like we're waking up from the industrial age as if from a bad dream. The model that I see increasingly is, looks like Monticello with broadband. the dream is that you're living, you know, in some sylvan glade. In fact, Disneyland has just redone Tomorrowland to do a kind of Tomorrowland that they call the Montana future. And, this is one in which you have, it's no more Formica and no more shiny aluminum and that future is gone. This is all about, you know, plants that are edible and a benign environment. And it could actually involve, you know, a radio with a wooden case and the knobs that feel good in your hands. Just because the texture of it in your hands is, you know, the part that feels good. Now, what's behind it is not going to be a tube, however. It'll be a chip.
Next up, we go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, Joel. Hi, George. This is Jeff calling from North Carolina.
Sure thing.
I'm interested in both the human enhancement movement and Mars colonization. And it seems to me that there's two ways we could colonize Mars. One is to change the Mars environment to suit human beings. But the other way is to change human beings through enhancement to fit the Mars environment. And my question to Joel is, in your Prevail scenarios and in your Prevail project there at Arizona State, have you looked at human enhancement benefiting Mars colonization, and how would that work?
Yeah. Not specifically. NASA, back in the 60s, was an organization that was pushing the whole idea of human enhancement, specifically because they thought that, I mean, they looked at how would you travel to the stars, and it was going to take, you know, centuries. And so they decided that the solution was to create a better kind of human. And so that's how they invented the phrase cyborg, which meaning part machine, part human. What you're seeing, I mean, we cyborgs do walk among us. I mean, Dick Cheney is part machine, you know.
Long suspected that.
Yeah, well, he is, you know. I mean, he's got
a pacemaker, and
he'd be long dead if it weren't for the fact that he has all this onboard hardware that's keeping him alive. So cyborgs walk among us. But the question is, you know, well, at what point do we give up our humanity? And I think that flips people out a lot. Flips me out. There are those who would argue, people in the heaven scenario would argue that as we increasingly merge with machines, it will just seem normal. The same way that that a Google implant will just seem like the next logical step. An implant that allows us to understand and speak Mandarin Chinese instantly will be just another step. I'm going to be interested to see how we process this, especially as it happens so fast. The question is, at what point do we start becoming unrecognizable as the kind of humans that we were? That, and how do we control that? How do we adapt to that? That's at the heart of the prevail issue. And I think this is, as I say, the core of prevail is that this is too important to leave to the scientists. It's too important to leave to the smart guys. This is the kind of thing that humans are going to have to debate and are going to have to start speaking about openly. Plastic surgery has been increasing by double digits every year for the last 20 years, and yet it's something we don't talk about. So we obviously have this desire to improve ourselves. We have this desire to use technologies to change ourselves, but we don't talk about it much. And if I don't do anything else, I hope I change that so that this, in fact, becomes an open part of the conversation and everybody gets involved.
Let's go to Mike in Eugene, Oregon. There you go, Michael. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, George.
Sure.
It's interesting. Every time I call, the questions are answered.
Before you get on, huh?
Yeah, well, it seems that way, especially tonight. I guess sort of what my question was similar to what you just spoke about. It had to do with the heart of humanity. I think we're going to look sort of funny and probably broken down if we're full of parts when we're, 80 years old or 90. And I guess a good question to ask is, how do scientists sort of limit their fervor for just advancement without, perspective? And then how do we as people who decide to get these products, draw the line and say, hey, that's really not necessary?
Right. Well, that's a really core question. When you talk to people who are deeply involved in this research, they're motivated to create new things, to discover new things, to be recognized for how innovative and brilliant they are, and they're really driven, to create a new world because it demonstrates, how sophisticated and how useful they are to humanity. So there isn't much in the way of built-in limits to this in the research process. That's why I think it's so important for ordinary humans to get together in a bottom-up way and start trying to, the first step is to realize that this curve of exponential change is occurring and that these technologies are in fact coming at us and that we're talking about an inflection point in history in which we're increasingly taking under control what it means to be human and how do we create our own humanity. That's the first step, is to realize that it's happening. And the second step is to start figuring out, what kind of humans do we want to be? What kind of children do we want to have? Inventing things like, okay, if we're going to be living for very long times, if we're going to be healthy for all that very long time, what's work going to be like? What's health going to be like? What is love going to be like? These are the questions that we got to start dealing with, because those are the human questions, and the ones that are the really interesting ones more than the technology questions.
Okay, let's go to Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, first-time caller. Dennis, go ahead.
Hey, George. Pleasure talking to you. I've been listening to you for about 7 years.
Well, thank you so much.
And as far as putting stuff away in savings, I believe it's hard enough just trying to get through month by month.
Sure thing, especially in Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We've been hit pretty hard. But before I get to the question, I want to ask you if my grandmother fell. She's in the hospital in Germany. If she could be on the prayer list.
You just email me her name and exactly what happened to her, and absolutely.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Now, what about the spiritual aspect of this whole thing? If I believe in reincarnation and we are born with a purpose, so our body is technically a vehicle. So dying is a big part of that. So if we're researching how to prolong our physical body, what about our spirit? And I mean, what about natural selection, or as I like to call it, because most people that are around that are 80, 90, they are mentally very in shape. Most of them have a very positive attitude. So I think those are the people that we want to have around versus people that are just...
Okay. Well, you haven't talked too much about spirituality tonight, right, Joel. How come?
Well, anti-aging medicine is going to do to the issue of reincarnation, boy, that's above my pay grade. I have no idea. I'm not particularly religious myself, but I have talked to a lot of people who are, because, I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that if we are talking about transcending what it means to be human, we ought to be talking to people who have given some thought about transcendence. And one of the things that I've been looking at is that an awful lot of people who are religious thinkers have been talking about the axial age. That's a period from 800 BC to around 200 BC, about 600 years, in which all of the major world religions kind of erupted around the world simultaneously among civilizations that couldn't possibly be in contact with each other. We see all of the Abrahamic religions get their start. We see the Greek philosophers, Confucianism, Buddhism, the whole thing. And the question is, well, what was in the water back then? You know, what suddenly happened? And one of the ideas that I've run into is the idea that this was the start of human consciousness as we understand today. And all of a sudden, we found ourselves facing these deep questions about, you know, why are we here? What is it all about? And the question I've got is whether, as we face these new challenges, whether, you know, we're going to be ending up with a spiritual response equivalent to the axial age, you know, in which we start dealing directly with the fact that, you know, we really are changing. You know, we're facing very profound questions, as profound as any we've ever dealt with, which is, you know, what does it mean to be human? What is human nature? And, you know, if we are having the capacity to change it, what should we do? That's a real different question from what can we do. Right now, it's all about what can we do. The question is, what should we do? And that's ultimately a spiritual question.
Joel's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. His latest work, Radical Evolution. Joel, thanks so much for being on the program. Up next, Gene Sasson joins us as we talk about growing up bin Laden. An interview with her. She co-wrote a book with Osama bin Laden's wife, one of them, and one of his sons. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.